It's time for the Douglas Coleman Show. Mr. Smooth and Savvy is joined by guests from all walks of life. From the entertainment industry, to authors, to political and social commentators. The famous and not so famous. The controversial and the light and fluffy. We have it all. Now, here's Douglas Coleman.
Okay, please welcome to the Douglas Coleman Show, Lisa Thompson. Hi, Lisa. How are you?
Hi, Douglas. I'm great. How are you?
Doing fine. Thank you. Thank you for coming on the show. I appreciate it.
Of course.
Your bio is pretty interesting. It's real interesting. And your story is fantastic. I kind of wanted to work a little bit in reverse and just find out what you're doing now. I know you have a book called Finding Elevation. Is the book out yet? It says forthcoming on your bio, so I don't know when it's coming out.
Yeah, it'll be published on January 10th of 2023.
So okay.
Next winter.
Okay, great. So the book is basically your story, right?
Yeah, the book is, at its heart, it's really a climbing memoir. So it will appeal to readers who are interested in mountains and in climbing or in mountaineering. But it's also a really deep and personal exploration into human motivation and risk-taking. And it's, you know, woven in there are anecdotes from my life. And I know we'll get to these details, but from fighting cancer and from learning to use my voice and building my resilience, both in life and in the mountains.
So are you also doing some kind of, you're doing like consulting work or something now?
So yeah, now I coach mountaineers.
A coach, okay.
I realized pretty early on that I took preparation for big mountains very seriously, often more seriously than other climbers. And so that pushed me or caused me to think about whether that was something that I could sort of contribute and give back to the mountaineering community. And so in 2018, I started a company called Alpine Athletics, and through that, I coach mountaineers of all levels, whether they're just getting started in the mountains or they're practicing or preparing to climb Mount Everest, I help them reach that goal.
It's interesting about mountain climbing. I know nothing about it, but the only thing that I've observed, it seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the people that do it are incredibly passionate about doing it. You know, it's not like, it's not like golf, where you have sort of these weekend hackers who just sort of go out there once in a while. I just like to putt around and hit the ball around. People who climb mountains are like intense about it. Would you agree?
I would absolutely agree. I think part of that comes from a sort of a stereotypical personality of mountaineers. We're usually fairly successful in other aspects of our life and want to just push the boundaries and find what we're made of. We're normally very detail-oriented folks who like adventure. And, you know, I think part of that intensity comes from commitment as well. As you said, you're sort of all in when you're climbing a big mountain like Everest. And there's big risk that comes with that too. You know, sometimes that includes death. And so, I think that pushes people to take it very seriously, which I think is warranted, and I think builds some of that intensity that you've noticed.
Yeah, I think so, too. I mean, I don't think there's a huge risk factor in golf, maybe, except to get struck by lightning.
You could get hit by a ball. That could happen.
Yeah, you could. You could, yeah. But, yeah, there's definitely risk in mountain climbing. Okay, so I would assume that if somebody is serious about it, you sort of work your way up, in a manner of speaking. I mean, you don't start with Everest. You start with something much smaller and kind of build your skill levels, yeah?
Yeah. Certainly that's the preferred route. I think there are some highly motivated folks who try to jump in to the deep end, but I think it's, you know, much more prudent to start with something small. And in my case, I live in Seattle, and I'm fortunate to be, you know, surrounded by beautiful mountain ranges almost all the way around me. And When I moved here, I was, you know, interested in the mountains, sort of interested in nature, but it wasn't until, I like to say that spite is what provoked me to start climbing. So in my first job after I moved to Seattle, I was the only woman at my level. And the guys, you know, my cohort would regularly go climbing on the weekends. And they were, you know, not by any means, not bad guys at all. It just didn't occur to them to ask the only girl in the office to join. And I, at that point in my life, didn't have enough courage, hadn't found my voice yet, and wasn't comfortable doing what would have been the logical thing, which would be to just say, hey, climbing, that sounds really cool. Can I join you? So instead, I got frustrated by the situation. And, you know, in hindsight, it wasn't that I, in that moment, was really interested in climbing. I was curious about it, but I didn't have this huge push or drive to start climbing. But what I was looking for was, I wanted to be seen as equal with my cohorts in the office, with those men. And I saw this, you know, these weekend outings as a way to do that. So as I said, I just started climbing on my own and climbed Mount Rainier, which is in Washington State, the highest peak in our state. And after that, I was hooked.
That's interesting. So was that the first sort of major mountain that you climbed?
Yeah, it was the first big mountain for me. And it is for a lot of people, too. You know, it's a very it's challenging, but it's approachable. And every year, you know, thousands of aspiring mountaineers, you get a taste of mountaineering on Mount Rainier. I was not successful in my first attempt up that mountain. The weather changed for the worse at about 11,000 feet. And so along with my team, I turned around. And I knew in that moment, though I was happy to turn around because I felt like I was in over my head, I just knew that I had more to do on that mountain. And so I came back the next year, and this is all with a local guide company. So, you know, had a lot of support and was in a learning environment. Came back next year and was successful. And I remember standing, you know, it's still dark outside. I was at about 13,000 feet and just looking to the south and seeing the horizon just start to come up for the first time that morning, and just realizing that I was experiencing things and seeing things that a lot of people don't get to. And that felt incredible to me. And that, along with the mental component of climbing and the physical component, plus, you know, being honest, there was still this need to prove people wrong. All of those things sort of mixed together into this, you know, this cocktail that I just couldn't get enough of.
How long does it take to climb? Well, let's just use Rainier then. You start like at a base camp, right?
Yeah. Yep.
So.
Yeah. In the case of. Oh, go ahead.
No, I was just trying to get a picture of how long. So you start at a base camp, you sleep there, you get up probably as soon as the sun comes up, right? You don't climb at night typically, right?
Actually, you do.
You
climb
do?
At night more typically. Oh,
okay.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
Yep. Yeah, that's because often the snow or the ice will be more stable because it's colder.
How do you see? You have big lights on your head? And
So, yeah, great question. So you wear just a headlamp.
Okay.
You see maybe a spelunker wearing. And that creates a really surreal sort of experience climbing at night. I actually like it quite a bit because your perspective really is just this small circle of light, and you can sort of feel the mountain around you. I think you can feel exposure. You can feel when you're close to the peak, but all you can really see is what's illuminated by that headlamp.
Wow. That would be scary, I think. I did scuba diving at night, and that was,
yeah.
Although it was really cool, it was a little bit scary because you only just saw that one little spot in front of you, and it was just black all
yep.
the way around. Yeah. And you didn't
yeah,
know what
yeah.
was coming out.
Very similar experience. I've never gone scuba diving at night, but it sounds very similar.
So back to my original question. So you get up to a certain point. You can't do the whole mountain in one shot, right? Don't you have to sleep periodically on the way up?
So most people will. On Mount Rainier, most people will. That mountain, it is possible to climb in a single push, just, you know, because of its size. So on Mount Rainier, you can drive to about 5,000 feet. You drive from sea level to Paradise, which is, there's a beautiful visitor center there, and it's highly recommended as a place to check out and see the mountain. And then from there, if you aspire to go higher, you really just start hiking, and you hike to about 10,000 feet. And as you get closer to that elevation, you'll be on the snow. And then beyond there is really where the fun starts and where you're climbing. And so the next 4,000 feet are more traditional. You're rope, there's crevasses, there's some, you know, rock fall hazard, and you're climbing. This is all on the disappointment cleaver route on Rainier, which is the most commonly climbed. And so most people will do that in a couple of days. There are, aspiring folks who will do it in less than that, but for most people it's two or three.
So there are places that you can sleep. I mean, I've seen some movies and things where people actually were hanging in this sort of pod.
Yeah. So that's a different type of climbing. That's big wall climbing, where you may strap a porta ledge to the rock, and you that becomes your home, and it's mobile. You pack it up and haul it with you up the mountain. Something I've never done, but looks just incredible and very intense.
Well, it's like sleeping in a hammock, except, you know, the drop is not 4 feet to the ground. It could be thousands of feet.
Gets your attention, for sure.
It certainly does. Yeah, I always thought, God, I would never want to do that. That would be too scary. You just roll over in the wrong direction. Well, I think you're kind of strapped into that, but...
You're anchored.
Yeah. Pretty amazing. All right, so it says on your bio that you are the second American woman to summit K2. Well, congratulations for that.
Thank you.
When did you climb K2?
I summited K2 in 2018.
Oh, okay, not that long ago. Now, how long does it take to... That one is, I would assume, a lot more challenging than Mount Rainier, right?
Yeah, a few steps up in intensity and challenge, for sure. So those mountains, big peaks like that, so K2 is the second highest mountain in the world, and it's in Pakistan. It straddles the border between Pakistan and China. And, in comparison to a mountain like Everest, which is in Nepal, and of course is the highest mountain in the world, all of those mountains are climbed by most people doing what are called rotations. And those rotations are necessary because they force your body, they force the psychological or physiological process in your body that creates more red blood cells. And those red blood cells are what's needed to survive at elevations as high as 29,000 feet, even if you're breathing supplemental oxygen. So the way that big climbs like that work are that you'll start from sort of the lowest village, the highest village that you can drive or helicopter to, and then you'll walk for sometimes a week. The trek into K2 base camp is about 40 miles, so you'll walk, that part of the trip is really enjoyable. You're walking through small villages and you're seeing pristine peaks, and often you're on the edge of a glacier. So that's sort of the enjoyable part. And then you get to base camp, and in the case of K2, that's at about 17,000 feet. And from there, you don't just start climbing. This is where the rotations come in. So you will, get to base camp and rest for a day or two, and then you'll begin to ascend 1,000 or 2,000 feet a day, and maybe spend the night at that higher elevation, and then return down to base camp to rest and recover for a few days. And then after that recovery period, you will start climbing again. You'll go to camp one, and then this time you'll go on to camp two and spend the night, maybe two nights, and then descend again all the way to base camp to rest and recover. And you repeat those rotations or that process until your body starts to acclimatize, and you eventually will go as high as, you know, it's usually the camp just below the summit, which is often, you know, camp 4 or 5, before you push all the way to the summit. So, you know, that process is, surprises a lot of people. I think a lot of people think you just sort of start walking and start climbing and go all the way to the summit, but there's, that's really a process that requires a whole lot of patience. There's actually a lot of downtime when you're climbing big mountains like that, a lot of time at base camp to, you know, read, contemplate, play cards, whatever it is to pass the time. But most people who climb, you know, big mountains like that, it takes about 6 weeks or 2 months to complete all those rotations and summit and then return safely to base camp.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, that does surprise me too. I had no idea that you were going up and down and up and down and up and down.
Yeah.
Now, is that because of the elevation that you just have to acclimatize your body to the essentially no oxygen? Can you just wear...
Exactly right.
Can you wear oxygen? Can you wear a tank?
So I climb with oxygen. I like oxygen. So I've always climbed with supplemental oxygen. Today I've heard different estimates of the impact in terms of altitude that supplemental oxygen provides. So for example, if you were at 25,000 feet, people will say that the relative elevation is probably more like 15,000 feet, maybe 18,000 feet. So it does not bring you back to sea level oxygen. It just gives you a little bit of help.
Oh, I see. Okay. And also the distances that you're going to be going on those rotations. I mean, in terms of, it's hard to measure in miles or kilometers, right? Because you're kind of going straight up, right?
Yeah, you are. And so, and we, you know, as mountaineers, don't really think of it in terms of distance, but more in terms of elevation gain. So a typical elevation gain on a big mountain in a day would be, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 feet, maybe 4. And that would take you, you know, many hours depending on how acclimatized you were.
So it could be straight up, or it could be at a steep angle or whatever, right?
Exactly right, yeah.
Yeah. Let me switch gears here for a second. It says you're a breast cancer survivor and in 2018 founded Alpine Athletics. And that's what you were talking about, your coaching, right?
Exactly, yep.
Well, congratulations for being a cancer survivor. That is,
thank you.
I think that's as harrowing probably as climbing the mountain.
Yeah.
In one sense, sure. Yeah. You were already climbing though, right? When you were diagnosed?
That's right, I was. I was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2015. And at that point in my climbing career, I had been climbing for about 7 years and had been, you know, each year taking on more and more challenging peaks and setting goals that would build my skill and ultimately my independence in the mountains. And so in 2015, I felt like I was ready to climb in the Himalaya for the first time. So the Himalaya is the mountain range that bisects Asia and contains Mount Everest as well as most of the highest peaks in the world. And in mountaineering terms, when we say a high peak, that's any mountain that's higher than 26,000 feet or 8,000 meters. And there's only 14 of those in the whole world. And so to feel ready and confident to climb one of them was a really big deal for me as a fledgling mountaineer. And I made the decision at the end of 2014 to attempt one of them called Manaslu. And at the beginning of 2015, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. And hearing those words directed at you or someone you love is shocking for everyone. And in my case, I was pretty cocky, you know, going into that situation. I was 42 years old. I was an athlete. I, you know, felt healthy. I, you know, ate organic vegetables and did all of those things that were led to believe will keep us healthy, you know, but it turns out that these cells in my left breast had just decided I felt to, you know, not follow the path that we had all been following along together for the previous 42 years. And so I became incredibly determined not to let cancer dictate my priorities. And in hindsight, that may not have been the best approach to take, but it certainly gave me motivation. And I, you know, was very transparent with all of my doctors that I still intended to climb this mountain in the fall. And I would say over time, I gained their support to do that, though they did, you know, admitted they had no baseline or example to draw from to see if that was, you know, safe or not. But I did have their blessing, and I went to Nepal that year and attempted Manaslu. I didn't summit, and I really believe that mountains teach you things. And sometimes you learn more, I think, when you don't, you know, when you're not successful according to sort of the standard definition of success. And so I came home from Nepal after not summiting Manaslu and realized that, you know, life is just incredibly fragile, and that it's up to each of us to define the lives that we will lead. And so I made a lot of significant changes in my life. I reprioritized many things and decided that if I was really passionate about climbing and the mountains, then, you know, why wouldn't I attempt Mount Everest? And so I then the next year climbed Mount Everest.
Wow, that's fantastic. So the cancer, the surviving of cancer actually pushed you further.
For sure it did. It was great. The greatest motivation for me to be back in the mountains. You know, I felt like cancer had stolen from me this thing that I loved that made me feel like me. And I was incredibly determined not to let cancer get the best of me. And, you know, and I think luck is part of that. I had an incredible team of physicians, you know, and healthcare providers supporting me, but I was very, very determined, yes.
So how long did you go through the treatments and surgeries and everything before they declared you cancer-free? How long was that process?
So it was actually pretty quick for me. I was fortunate that I didn't need to have chemotherapy. My tumors were all removed with surgery, and I had surgery in April after being diagnosed in February. And then trained to climb Manaslu, came back, and then had reconstructive surgery between Manaslu and Everest.
Oh, so you just, wow. Okay, so there was not a lot of downtime then, really.
Yeah, there wasn't for me. I feel very grateful for that, and very grateful to have a skilled surgeon who, you know, was competent and able to remove all the tumors without needing any chemo.
Oh, that's great. So you didn't have to do any kind of chemo or any sort
no.
of... I was no. just speaking with a cancer researcher at Johns Hopkins, a doctor, and she was telling me that there is some really good immuno... And I'm going to screw it up, the name of it. But it's something that was more recently developed, and it sort of paralleled research with HIV, and they're finding that some of the treatments are actually working. They actually have good results with certain types of cancers. And, you know, it's similar to chemo in the way that it's administered, but it doesn't have all the awful side effects like chemo can have with people.
That's fantastic to hear. Very encouraging. I'm grateful to cancer. I wasn't in the moment, but now I am, because it taught me a lot of things. And one of the things that I aspire to do now is to give back to women who have breast cancer or gynecological cancers. And it's just heartbreaking sometimes to sit with them and see the things that they're going through and the impact it's having on their lives. And you wonder, you know, why medicine can't be better.
Well, it's true. And even with cancer, I mean, she was saying that, as advances the treatments are getting, there's never going to be a one-size-fits-all cure, because cancer is so varied. There's so many
Absolutely.
Different types. And even amongst certain types of cancers, there's subgenres and you know what I mean? It just goes on and on forever. It's incredible.
Yeah.
But they're getting better.
Wow.
I mean, it's certainly better. I lost my father to cancer in the early 1980s, and there was just very little you think 1980 was, 40 years ago. But even in the 40 years now, we've really come a long way with treatments. He only had radiation as his option for treatment. And he stopped doing it because he thought the treatment was worse than the cancer. Which,
yeah, my father died of cancer, and he felt the same way. He stopped treatment because he felt like it was worse than the cancer.
Yeah,
which is horrible to experience.
Well, right, when the medicine is worse than the illness, it really makes you think about it. Last question, and then we got to kind of wrap this up. So Alpine Athletics and you're coaching aspiring climbers, give me one, I don't want to say mistake, but what is one, people come in with one particular idea about mountain climbing and they're generally wrong on it.
Yeah. And people will come to me, after they've attempted a mountain like Rainier and been unsuccessful. And realize that fitness is a part of the equation to be successful. And to me, success is, you know, returning safely to base camp, whether or not you sit on the summit. And so often those people didn't consider that mountaineering is an endurance activity. And their training looked something like, you know, going to the gym, squatting, you know, a bunch of big weights, doing a bunch of pull-ups, you know, really building a lot of bulk and muscle mass, and overlooking how important it is to train as an endurance athlete. And that training, you know, is not sexy. It's not like what you see people doing and, you know, puking in a bucket in the corner of the gym. It's very low intensity. A lot of volume. So things like, you know, hiking for 5 hours or running 15 miles at a moderate heart rate are what build up your cardiovascular capacity as an endurance athlete. And people often don't consider that before they attempt a mountain. And what will happen is that their physiology simply is not prepared to work for multiple hours on successive days, and you know, they sort of flag out. So it's actually fun for me to, you know, I don't wish that on anybody, but it, you know, part of my job as a coach is to educate and to make, you know, add value to the overall climbing community. And so it's fun for me to work with those folks and really teach them what it means to be successful in the mountains and what it means to be an endurance athlete. And then, you know, to watch them go out and put it into practice is really cool.
So you body type, you really want to be like one of those long-distance marathon runner.
You do. Yeah. When I see people in the mountains, they're big, you know, bulky. I think, oh, gosh, it's just, you have so much more mass to oxygenate, so much more mass to carry. And, you know, when you look at mountaineers, we're often, you know, pretty lean and lanky.
Well, even if you look at some of the films from people who have taken expeditions to Everest, the locals are all tiny people. Yeah, the ones with the yaks, you know. And did you get any yaks in your expedition? Did you have yaks?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I've had lots of time with yaks. Yeah, they can be pretty surly, those yaks.
Well, they look pretty amazing. Pretty rugged animals, I tell you.
They are.
But yeah, the people who own the yaks and who work with them, I mean, they're very small people. But they're perfectly accustomed to that elevation.
Right? Yeah, totally. So, you know, which motivates me. So I'm 5'4" and weigh 115 pounds. So I'm a small person too. And the ethnic group, the Sherpas, who work in the mountains, who live there, are tiny, just like me. So it always motivates me. I always see, you know, these men just not much taller than me carrying impressively heavy loads at altitude, and it inspires me to think that I can do it too.
Oh, and they carry them on their back with just like a strap or something. I mean, I've seen some of these videos. It's unbelievable. The packages, the bundles that they're carrying are often bigger than them.
Yeah. Right? Yep. And I think it's important to acknowledge that too. I mean, I've had Sherpa support on every mountain I've climbed in the Himalaya, and I could not people like me. I could not climb that mountain without their support and their strength and their tenacity, you know, and just really taken a lot from them and their culture over the years.
Oh, absolutely. All right, Lisa. Well, we're going to wrap this up. Do you have a website that you want to give out?
Yeah. Yep. So my website is lisaclimbs.com.
Okay. And information on your book, your upcoming book, is on the website as well?
Yep, it's on the website. And if listeners want to receive an early copy of the prologue in the first chapter, they can do that via the website. And then you can also learn more about Alpine Athletics through alpineathletics.net, or there's a link from the Lisa Klein site too.
Okay, great. Well, thank you for coming on the show. This was a nice conversation. It was nice meeting you.
My pleasure. I enjoyed it.
And best of luck with the book. I hope it does well when it comes out.
Thanks, Douglas. I appreciate it.